What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Matthew Rozak is the co-founder of Block and the entrepreneur who gave Richard Branson and Bill Clinton their first Bitcoin. In this conversation, we talked about the early days of Bitcoin, how crypto has evolved over the last 10 years, and why Matthew is building a company now. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well. I'm sure a lot of you have used Kayak to find the best flight. Total's kind of like Kayak, but it don't find you no flights. It helps you find liquidity on decentralized exchanges, and it optimally routes your trades for execution. So Kayak, you find flights. Total, they help you find liquidity. We should get Kayak on it for this spot that I'm providing them, but Total instead is our advertiser, and you should go visit total.com/pomp. Again, that's total.com/pomp, and let them know that I sent you, tell them you love their product, take a screenshot, tweet it at me, I'll drop you some fire emojis, and then we'll all be happy. So total.com/pomp.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, I'm super excited. We have one of the legends in crypto, frankly, Mr. Matt. So thank you so much for coming on here and spending some time with us. You've got a interesting background, lots of stuff kind of pre-crypto. Maybe let's start there, and then we can talk about what initially got you excited about cryptocurrency and blockchain.
Yeah, absolutely. I started in the private equity space, and I thought that was the that was going to be the end all be all. So I got a job with Advent International early in my career. Advent's a big private equity shop based in Boston. I was in their London office. I think they're up to $30 billion under management now. And investing in very pragmatic cash flow branded businesses. But at the time, this is like late 99. And so I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing this internet kind of grow and kind of burst on the scene. And Advent was very disciplined in how they invested and essentially missed the whole internet up and down the dot-com dynamic, and they stayed very disciplined. I actually left Advent and raised a fund and started deploying capital in the early internet. And it's fascinating to look at that against what's happening in crypto last few years in terms of all the effervescence and, you know, what people call bubbles and the rest of it. But kind of looking back at that moment in time and seeing, you know, capital formation, new tech, entrepreneurship, and that whole dynamism was amazing to watch. And there's a lot of analogs we can cover in terms of the back and forth, some lessons learned, some not. And so after that, I started my own fund. Started investing in companies. I also co-founded a few enterprise software companies in HR, construction management, emergency notification space, took three companies public. So it's a very active builder, investor in tech companies. But after the dot-com crash, you know, it was on one hand, cool, fun, exhilarating to be an investor in companies, but at the tail end of that, I had to learn how to operate businesses. I had to learn how to find a compass in a particular company and help them kind of retrench, grow, etc. So that was a very important lesson for me in my career, and kind of now, including to this very day, not only invest but also build. In the tech space, the interesting dynamic of getting into crypto. So I was chairman of a social gaming company, in Singapore. And when you're in social gaming, you quickly learn that payment processing becomes a core competency. You never thought of that, but it's like cross-border payments in Southeast Asia, to PayPal and credit cards and bank transfers. You have all these frictions, costs, and issues. And I remember there was this platform that tried to get gaming credits from different gaming platforms and create an exchange for those gaming credits. And there was a lot of kind of ideation and build out of that. And then at the same time, Bitcoin kind of came on the scene. This is now circa 2011. And I at that time, I had my, you know, we all remember our aha moment, but I thought, wow, this could be something to have us entertain on a universal gaming credit. And and kind of went down the rabbit hole after that. So it took me about a year to really understand it, really start to put some money towards Bitcoin and kind of get down this rabbit hole. So by 2012, 2013, I started investing in a lot of the bridges, roads, and tunnels of crypto and blockchain. So I was one of the early LPs in Blockchain Capital, and we invested in Coinbase and Kraken and Zappo, et cetera, made a lot of direct investments. So by 2013-ish, about 20 plus companies, and even early stuff that doesn't exist anymore, like Robocoin, the world's first Bitcoin ATM. But out of all these entrepreneurs you meet, all these investments, technology platforms, you always learn something. It's always an additive kind of piece. And that kind of helps build this kind of heat map as you move forward. And then after investing in these what I'd say operating companies, the bridges, roads, and tunnels, we saw the ICO explosion and was relatively early and got to get exposure to a lot of some of the amazing entrepreneurs in this space in the early days, like Vitalik, David Johnson, and a few others. So I was early in Ethereum and MadeSafe and Factum and a lot of the early ICOs. And after that, invested in over 70 different projects, every Ethereum killer on the planet. And again, this is all kind of additive and serial in terms of how you see this evolution of tech and people and networks. But after that, I really wanted to build a company, and I was also along the way. So starting in about 2013, I organized these dinners. And they were pretty simple. It was like you get, you know, 10 folks around a conference to go and grab a bite to eat. And the first one was pretty cool. It was in in Vegas in December 2013. And there were some interesting characters that showed up. And at that time, it was, you know, nobody really knew what to do, how to do it. We're all kind of making up as we're going along. There were some that certainly had a better compass and perspective than others. But you know, around that table, there were folks like Vitalik and Charlie Lee from Litecoin, Bobby Lee, brother, Brock Pierce, CZ from Binance. Lots of just great entrepreneurs to this day. And from there, those relationships and those dinners kind of carried on. So kind of looking back over the shoulder, I've done like, I don't know, 50 plus dinners. And, you know, I kind of look at that number and I'm just like, wow, that's a lot of dinners. In each dinner, I always seem to learn something. I build a new relationship, and out of these dinners, I've invested in people, hired people, built partnerships. It's just been a really cool center of gravity for me to learn about people around food and cool cities. And done this and everywhere from San Fran, Chicago, Berlin, Singapore, Rio, you name it. And so that was really cool to build this network of technologists and entrepreneurs that's helped me in terms of investing and building just a broader compass in this space. And whenever I don't know something or I'm trying to figure something out, it's usually trying to figure that out is a phone call away, which is always helpful. And that's how I actually got to meet my co-founder at Block, Jeff Garzik, who has been a dear friend of mine for a long, long time. And about 3 years ago, we got together to form Block. And his background, he's got this very unique and rare Venn diagram where kind of the circles around him are composed of working directly with David Provald at Linux. He was a kernel developer there, and also was one of the early Bitcoin core developers back in the days of when Satoshi and Gavin and Jeff was one of the first guys on the scene. And so, arguably worked on two of the most powerful open source projects in history. And so with that, we wanted to build a lot of infrastructure. Still to this day, lots of the infrastructure that we need to scale this space needs to get enhanced, get enterprise grade, get ready for these trillion-dollar networks that we all foresee. But we got a lot of work to do today. We're 10 years into Satoshi's white paper, 3 years into Block, and I kind of look at where we're standing, and we still have a lot of work to do. So in building a lot of that infrastructure, we set out to launch Block and try and tame some of those issues. And so that's my primary focus today is building and supporting Block. I was taught early in my career to not only invest and build, but also to give back. And there's it's interesting this space on how a lot of entrepreneurs have resources now, and I think there's resources that when you think about redeploying into building out this ecosystem to philanthropy and giving back, and I think there's some cool ways to do that with blockchain technology. BitGive, which I'm a part of, has this project called GiveCrack. Binance's philanthropy organization is doing some cool things, and so I like seeing and doing more of that. And then also, when you get in the early days of crypto, no banks, no government, no nothing. It's pretty intoxicating for the first 3 minutes, and then you realize, wait, the world is wired a particular way, and so you need to educate and advocate for this technology. And I also serve as chairman of the Chamber of Digital Commerce, which is the largest trade association in the space. So engage with regulators, heads of state, and try and help that narrative. And it's gone a long way. That was formed about 5 years ago. So it's been a long path there.
Got it. And what do you feel like? Because you've done so much, right? And kind of done it all over the world. As you've traveled around, maybe give me your understanding or your experience over the years of the different areas or geographies. What's the general feeling about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and blockchain? Is it pretty kind of universal, the response and reception, or do you see pretty significant differences in different regions?
I think it's a great question. And I think you kind of sense it, geographically. If you put a heat map over the globe on where the heat is in this space, obviously the U.S., there's a lot going on here with capital markets, institutional investors, et cetera. But those institutional investors are still on the sidelines for the most part, although paying very close attention. I think institutional investor in the world has crypto on their whiteboard and are strategically thinking through how to take a bite at this apple. No question about it. I think a lot of the infrastructure is either wet cement or getting built. And I think over the next year or two, I think it'll be a massive kind of uptake in that. But taking a step back on the global heat map, the U.S. is amazing, but I would give it a B. I would give Europe probably a C. And I think there's some pockets in Europe, Berlin and London and Amsterdam, that are pretty phenomenal. Some great developers in Poland. And then, you know, when you fly over to Asia and you do a tour of Singapore, Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, you're just like, and Tokyo for that matter, your jaw drops of the get it factor, the capital, the pace of innovation, entrepreneurs that are building stuff in a much different pacing. So I would say, you know, Asia is an A in this space, and some of that is getting also helped by like the Singaporean government. You know, has been very embracing this technology and doing some just amazing stuff. Regulators do not innovate. I mean, you know, the pace of technology far outpaces what regulators could keep up with, and we always harp on them for wanting to get their acts together, but they're not incentivized to do that. And so when you see somebody like, you know, a geography like Singapore and Switzerland to that matter, it's pretty inspiring, and capital and entrepreneurs are flocking to that. Obviously, Zug and Switzerland has an amazing pocket, but when you transpose that against what's happening in Asia, it's pretty unbelievable, and sometimes it makes you feel like San Fran is like a flyover town in this space. You know, that means Silicon Valley, right? It's like, yeah, there's crypto funds there, and you know, a lot of Sand Hill Road VCs, top quartile VCs that are just, you know, measured in months building crypto practices and dedicated crypto funds, but it's been over the recent past. And sometimes I spend a lot of time in Asia. So when I talk to like entrepreneurs in like Singapore or in Seoul or wherever, and they're like, yeah, I'm gonna take capital and build an office in San Fran and build my community. And I'm kind of like, well, why? You have a massive opportunity right here in Asia. Go with, you know, all the kind of natural, you know, resources and benefits, advantages you have here. Versus, you know, going to San Fran, which seems like everybody's wish list playbook, but it's not necessarily necessary in this space, because you can build and run and operate on a much more decentralized basis. So I wish the regulatory regime in the U.S. was a bit better. I think that will be helpful. I think we will get it over time. And I think that will normalize some of the capital inflows, the tokenization dynamic, and get back to, I think, a more balanced state here.
Got it. And I guess as you think about the evolution here, what are the things that, given your time in the space, you're most proud of? And then what are some of the things that you think we've got the most work to do, right? So kind of like, let's say take today as point in time in March of 2019, maybe give us the positives from the last couple of years, and then what do you think are those big challenges moving forward?
I think sometimes people think the negatives of this ICO Cambrian explosion mess things up. I think it's just this whole ecosystem, and even Bitcoin is like this organism, right? And it gets stressed and heals and finds its way to kind of evolve through, you know, capital ups and downs of the market, regulatory dynamics. I think the whole ICO explosion, the tokenization of assets, tokenization of networks, tokenization of money is a fantastic thing. And there's a lot of money that was invested, and not all projects are going to be great. And, you know, but if history is any lesson for us, whether it was railroads or telephony or internet or now these new rails of crypto. I think that innovation and being able to attract that much capital, which was primarily retail capital or enthusiast capital, if you will, with no institutional involvement, was profound. I mean, I just like off the chart. And people always talk about, it's a bubble. These are speed bumps. You know, we're kind of going after new money factors, new identity factors, and just the whole behavioral thing of tokenizing networks and assets is a phenomenal thing. So it's going to take a while to get there. But in seeing that and teaching people about tokenizing these networks was a big deal, and the capital formation around it. Now, you know, we're seeing a big thematic STO dynamic, the security token offerings, which I think medium long term is going to absolutely be a thing. You know, tokenization of cap tables, of hotels, bars of gold, pick your favorite underlying asset, tokenizing those, the fractional ownership, the liquidity premiums, pricing. Price discovery, getting friction out of the system is all awesome. It is going to happen, and it's happening. I think the pace of it over the near term is going to be a little wobbly as companies raise money, burnish tokens off their cap table, and the trading of that, I think, is going to take some time for institutions to plug into those trading platforms, create that liquidity and that price discovery dynamic. So I think it's a little disjointed, but I think some of the early good companies at STO, I think, will get rewarded. But the pacing is a little fuzzy to me in terms of, you know, how long that's going to take. And I think the other dynamic of STOs, where it's a good thing, and you've probably seen this, a lot of institutional investors don't necessarily understand distributed compute or storage or all these tokenized networks of Web3, but they do understand shopping centers. They understand, you know, apartment buildings, and tokenizing that or cap tables is a very comfortable, understandable asset for them. And so I think institutions will be predisposed to doing more there, but the undercurrent of adoption to then spread bets amongst other crypto currencies, tokenized networks, I think will benefit from that. So the overcurrent will still be, you know, STOs over the near term, and the undercurrent of you know, great projects that are utility tokens, I think, will be the undercurrent that'll surface again near term.
Got it. And so maybe let's talk a little bit about, you know, how this fits into Block and what you're building today and the vision you have for the company.
Yeah. So Block, we go to market in two different ways. Block Enterprise, where we support Fortune 50 and Crypto 50 customers for this kind of multi-token, multi-protocol, network future. And so we build stuff that is, you know, not just on Ethereum or not just on Bitcoin, but we also believe that the interoperability of a wallet or a node or any of the connective tissue, these tokenized networks, has to be done on that basis, which makes it harder to build, harder to test, harder thing, but also provides some risk adjustment and some longevity to the stuff that we're building. You know, our customers there are large bank asset managers, et cetera. The more interesting part of our customer base is the Crypto 50s. These are scaled, large, native crypto businesses that need a lot of the same APIs and data services and infrastructure that the Fortune 50 are looking to build too. That being said, on Block Enterprise, the dynamic there is that, you know, we're not just, you know, building blockchains and filling out you know, a particular PowerPoint for some big public company that wants a headline. You see some of that where, you know, people are putting cabbage on a blockchain, and On one hand, it's good for large public regulated businesses to engage in blockchain, but they're not touching the public networks. These are, you know, intranets, extranets at best. But you know, if history is any lesson, this is what they did with early internet. This is what they did with cloud. You know, when they had hybrid cloud or private clouds. So we're seeing a lot of the same behavior. What we do is we focus on those that want to engage in public tokenized networks, these value networks. That's where we think the value is. And we're building towards that. And so that's Block Enterprise. And you know, we've built wallets for lots of banks and asset managers and continue to enhance our product suite. We have a few announcements to make in the next couple of months. So we're always iterating and adding to that suite. So that's Block Enterprise. On the other side of the house, we have Block Labs, where we build new tokenized networks and applications. And so a few years ago, in the early kind of ICO days, a lot of folks are coming to us with their white papers. And either they got funding or they were just about to fund and they needed help on the build out of these networks, whether it's other EVM or some of the architecture of their protocol. They needed help and they call on us and we so these are projects like Quantum and Civic and a few others. And then we realized that, you know, we have these rare developers on our team that understand how to build stuff, understand token economics and all these dimensions of building these new networks. And so we set out a strategy to building our own tokenized networks. And the first one that we built and launched was called Metromill, which is a new novel cryptocurrency. And it was a feat, to be honest, because it was it's a cryptocurrency, so it's a digital money that is autonomous. And so when we launched it, we then not have any further ability to change a Metronome. So it was a DAO, you know. And the last time, you know, a decentralized autonomous organization. And so the last time somebody did that. In the DAO, it went horribly wrong. It was very complicated, very poorly constructed. And so, in building Metronome, we audited it five different ways, tested it five different ways with external parties, and launched it last year in June. Raised about $13 million. But what's unique about the raise is the descending price auction put those proceeds, and it was done in Ethereum on Ethereum, put those proceeds into a smart contract. So it didn't go into some foundation or go into Block's pocket. It went to the Metronome community, whereby that smart contract, the only thing you can do is autonomously convert Metronome to ETH or ETH to Metronome out of that smart contract. And so that was new and novel, use of proceeds, the fact that it's autonomous. And the next big push for us is to do a chain hop. So this is also a cross-chain cryptocurrency where, again, the relationship with your crypto, I think in the future is going to change, where you get to elect and self-govern where your token resides. And we'll look at, you know, rails like Ethereum and EOS and Stellar and Cardano more like security rails versus, you know, being pinned down into a particular network. And so the thought around Metronome was be able to move your crypto to another rail. And so even our white paper wasn't called a white paper, it was called an owner's manual. And so you have this new self-governance, you decide where to put it, type of relationship, which again was super new, super novel. And so the chain hop is first one's going to be on Ethereum Classic because it's same bloodline essentially as Ethereum, and we're going to be moving forward onto EOS. We're looking at BNB and to others. And so I think ultimately, some of these protocols will, not only for Metronome, but will compete for other projects and other tokenized networks to reside on their networks, on their native protocols. So it'll be cool to see that future play out. Meaning, you know, if you have $1 billion of market value on a particular rail, and another rail says, well, I've got all this other features and support and other things I'm going to do to enhance your network, people will move their token to another rail. And I think that'll be an interesting competitive dynamic in where tokens ultimately reside. And it's almost like you could see this future where these tokens kind of move like a swarm of bees or birds between different rails in that particular future. So Metronome, we're super proud of that. It was really hard to build, and we're exercising and getting more utility on that with exchanges and payment processors and payroll providers to get some usage and exercise that more and more. So super excited about that. Another project that we launched about a month ago at the Binance conference in Singapore was Titan. And Titan provides an operating system for miners. And so a lot of miners today, are thinking on a short term, so they're not necessarily operating in the most efficient way possible. And so, they're doing some hacks, maybe they're throwing more bodies and issues than software and code. And so what we did is we built a software suite and a network to help alleviate that and make miners more profitable, more efficient. And it does three different things. One is your device, and it's much easier than one device. And if you can imagine doing 1,000 or thousands of devices, bigger industrial mines, where it auto detects the machine, it's identifies it, secures it, and configures it immediately. And you can do different things with like fan speed, up clocking, down clocking the chip, et cetera, to get more juice out of the fruit, if you will. And then secondly, does automation of pool switching and where you point your hash power. And so the team with Titan is the guys that build CoinWars, Rig Wars, Pool Wars, and Ryan Condren, the CEO there, has been a principal engineer at Block for a couple of years, and so we're super excited about this one. And then ultimately, the goal there is beyond the utility of making them more profitable and more efficient, create a hash power marketplace. That's the ultimate goal there for Titan. So super excited about that. The other project that's about to launch in a couple of weeks is Veriblock, which people, I mean, you get this asked like, what is Bitcoin, right? And it's got so many different dimensions, like store of value, payments, machine to machine, all these different kind of pizza box layers on top of Bitcoin. One thing that Veriblock is doing is using Bitcoin's security as a service. So underpinning and securing other blockchains with Bitcoin. And so the future there, which is kind of interesting, could be that Bitcoin is a security route for all other blockchains, public, private, et cetera, and kind of creates this really powerful, security route for kind of this state of crypto. So, super excited about those. So we continue to build out of Block Labs. That's something that we continue to iterate what the thesis and compass is on what's the next thing that we build. We're very focused on a handful of projects today. We won't do 100. Projects a year, but we can focus on less than a handful, try and do that right.
And so, look, what you're describing is a pretty bold vision for a number of different projects that tackle various aspects of the industry. Maybe talk a little bit about, your perspective, and I've been fascinated with this in conversations with you, is there is a bent towards building over any sort of actual trading or what I'll call more kind of short-term profit taking. How do you, one, kind of decipher between the two activities, right? Building versus trading. And then two is maybe talk a little bit about if you weren't you, right? Meaning that you were just starting out, getting excited about cryptocurrency learning, what are some of the places that you would look for opportunity to either enter into the industry or to start to participate in things that could be kind of sustainably valuable over the next couple of years?
Yeah, now I like the word sustainability because there's this business model or this general model with holding crypto and kind of we are now like seed stage in many ways despite 10 years into the ball game here for Bitcoin. We're at a seed stage level, a couple hundred, less than a couple hundred billion in market value, 130 billion or whatever today-ish. We're talking about trillion-dollar networks, and the whole medium of money is changing dramatically. And in the early internet days, people were excited about putting, pet food and women's shoes online. That was like a thing. That was like, going to change the world. And so now, and seeing how this space is evolving, the trading, I was on a panel a few weeks ago, and the guy next to me was this like renowned trader, ex-Goldman, and talking about charting and Sharpe ratios and everything. I mean, he was just like had a mental model on some of the stuff. And that's not necessarily my cup of tea. I am a buy and hold. I've pretty much held on to a lot of the stuff that I've invested in. And I think this space right now is still a something to invest in, but not to trade. And there's a lot of people that probably made a ton of money trading the ups and downs every single day. But it's hard to keep up already with news in this space. I can't imagine how much sleep and everything else I'd have to sacrifice to stay on top of the trading part of this. So I'm predisposed to building and investing and seeing where we are in this crypto winter. I've seen now, three plus of these types of downturns where we're 70, 80% down. And the only thing I wish I could do is buy more, build more, hire more back. That's my only regret analysis. I wish I did more. And so now we're in this crypto winter. And what's interesting is it doesn't feel like winter. I mean, if you look at all the institutional infrastructure plays that are coming about, you look at some of the financing that are happening. The crypto spring. It's around the corner, and it's I think it's going to be bigger and more profound. And I think that there's the institutional capital is one of the things. I mean, there's like these two flywheels in this space, right? There's the crypto speculation, and then there's network utility. And the crypto speculation has kind of gone ho hum over the recent past, but the blockchain utility, quite frankly, still home, right? Because you don't have a lot of people doing throughput and transaction value and in any material way to change their business, obviously the remittance, the payments and all that stuff, absolutely. But real utility of industries and companies doing it, it's still, no one's got balance sheet risk, so to speak, on a particular blockchain or network. But once the institutions come in, I think the crypto speculation, that whole flywheel, goes up 10x without blinking an eye. And I think once the blockchain utility, network utility starts to show some movement, I think that's a 10x. And so that's 100x without a lot of fancy math, just seeing who's sitting around this ecosystem from an investment standpoint, who's building in this ecosystem, and the intellectual capital of this space is bringing in is pretty amazing. So I am as bullish as I've ever been. And I feel like they're the history of the price swings and all the headlines and everything else. I feel like now it's not a question of is this going to happen? It's happening, and so some of the pace is going to get a little different. So you got to be pragmatic on one hand. On the other side, it's I feel like generally this industry knows a secret that most other people walking on the street don't know, because they were turned off because 10 years ago it was drug money, or they're turned off because last year the headline was lost 80% of your dollar, and so that'll take a lot of people out of the equation. But at the same time, I can't find a better place to spend my time, energy, and everything else.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to, your kind of deep-seated long-term belief. I recently tweeted and said, you basically have to be delusional at this point to think that digital assets in general aren't going to be the standard of the future. And I spend a lot of time thinking about what are the bearish arguments, right? So like, I'm with you that I believe probably more strongly than most. What do you think are the biggest threats to that, right? In terms of, if we said 10 years from now, hey, Bitcoin, crypto, it didn't work out, what's the most likely reason why that would happen?
I think there's also competitive dynamics. I mean, there's incumbents, banks, and existing players that probably want a longer ride with the infrastructure and the products and services that they have. I mean, why wouldn't they? And so, they'll likely lobby for, maybe more enhanced regulation that would favor them versus the crypto whippersnapper. And so I think the competitive dynamics of incumbents, I think the pace of regulation and how that evolves could compress it. I think this, the way I look at it is like, it compresses the air hose. It doesn't flow as fast as it probably should, but it doesn't, I don't think it kills it. I just think it the adoption and some of the other dynamics get obscured. I think it's hard to, and then you look at the other side of the equation, forget Wall Street and Silicon Valley. Think about, the guys in Venezuela or, other parts of the world where this is game on. It's working. It's a massive life changer, and that is going to continue. It's going to be hard to extinguish that. And so, those edge cases will continue to get better and better, more refined, easier. And I think, in developing countries, I think the narratives continue to spread. I mean, we're tribal people, right? I tell you to say, hey, download this photo sharing app called Instagram and, share pictures of the food we eat. Great. It's a low bar, but, I kind of encourage you to do that. If it's, download this wallet and, put money in here, your trust bar is higher, cause it's money versus, food picks. And so I think as the story evolves on Bitcoin and other crypto in developing nations, I think that's going to continue to be a massive dynamic. And Bitcoin was never going to go, whatever. I mean, how many currencies are out there? 120 currencies globally. I don't think it's going to start at the top. It's going to start at the bottom, and take up the bottom quartile of currencies. And it'd be interesting to see which country adopts a crypto as their native currency out of the gate. But we'll see this slow kind of dynamic of adoption. But the institutional piece, the bigger money piece with pensions and banks and regulators, I think that's going to take time to iron out. And I think we've seen enough of that, historically, in terms of regulatory arbitrage and how incumbents, a lot of incumbents have been, going to DC for 100 years, trying to make an imprint there. But that's also a competitive dynamic. So I think competition is going to continue to enhance in this space.
For sure. And I guess really one of the things that is interesting to me is there's very different mindsets when it comes to the different societies around the world. I know you spent a ton of time in Asia. What are like the biggest differences in the entrepreneurs based in Asia versus maybe the ones that you see in the Western world, specifically like the US and North America? Is it anything that's like really obvious, or do you feel like entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs everywhere?
I think entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs everywhere. I think, you know, it depends how much resources and water and sunlight entrepreneurs get and attention. Some entrepreneurs will break through no matter what. But capital formation, regulatory dynamics will help spawn more and more and tap into the font of innovation. And I think in Asia, there's this dynamic in a lot of parts of the world. So in China, you know, the early days of Bitcoin was all the trading, all the mining happened in China. And maybe that turned into an advantage, a psychological advantage for a lot of folks in Asia, where, you know, they distrust the government, they distrust banks, you know, how do they take capital out of their countries. And so the utility of Bitcoin or the thought and philosophy of Bitcoin to them maybe resonated a lot sooner, earlier, better in certain ways. But, you know, the entrepreneurial dynamics in Asia in this space are off the charts right now.
Absolutely. And I guess as you've thought about building your team, right? So kind of that's the entrepreneur mindset or whatever, but you guys have hired quite a few people and obviously have a really strong leadership team. But what's some of the things that maybe you screen for in that hiring process that either you haven't done in non-crypto businesses or you think are very specific to this industry?
A great question. I mean, what's amazing is to my earlier comment, what people get magnetized to this space. And it's like, you know, you can think of any, you know, either a big company or a law firm or even government agency. Some of the smartest people in those shops gravitate to this tech, and they're the ones that are the blockchain lead or the head of blockchain or whatever. And it's super cool to see that. And so we spend a lot of time trying to find some of the best people for the areas that we're filling out. A couple of the recent hires, we hired Hadley Stern from Fidelity. So he started the crypto blockchain practice there with Abby, the CEO, 4 years ago. He's been there for 16 years, now chief operating officer of Block. And so that was a recent hire. We hired Phil Gomes from Edelman. He ran blockchain at Edelman. And we didn't hire Phil because he was at Edelman. We hired Phil because he was Phil. He got great narratives. You guys would get a long pump. Just great narratives, great storytelling. And you need that in this space. You know, you need the choice of words and how to put stuff in context. Super important. So he's chief communications officer Block, and some of the executive talent at Block continues to get upgraded. But we continue to look out for awesome devs, and so, you know, having Jeff's Halo Bitcoin core developer and a few other folks on our team helps that. And even in the earliest days of Block, we have sponsored lots of devs, and it's kind of strange to say that a startup is sponsoring a developer. And in open source, this is like a key piece. I'd love to see more companies do this. So we sponsored Andreas Schobach, lives in Berlin. He's inventor of the Android Bitcoin wallet, maintains Bitcoin J, which a lot of exchanges use today as part of infrastructure. And he's been on our payroll for 3 years now. Awesome guy, huge contributor, does very little for Block, but we thought it was the right thing to do, where he contributes all his time, energy to make Bitcoin better, invented some awesome apps and infrastructure. And so And by the way, he made his Bitcoin J, which is what I think Mike Hearn was managing before he left Bitcoin. And so, but anyway, just doing stuff like that, I think is important. That helps recruit and helps people understand how you do stuff. Also in Block Labs, we have a lot of engineers that build stuff for Block, and then they have this passion project or the side project. And then when they kind of, tell us about it, we're like, wow, that's an awesome idea. And so, a couple of our projects stem from that as well, where, somebody wrote a white paper 3-4 years ago, and it's been kind of gnawing at them, and we kind of put resources around it to have it see the light of day. The answer to your question, ultimately, yeah, a lot of these guys are super professional, awesome CVs, et cetera, but you have to be a good human. You have to be an awesome person. That's a key piece, especially in a smaller, we're less than 50 people. We're pretty decentralized. And so, we've got, a few mantras like, high expectations, limited guidance. You got to know how to get stuff done, but you got to be an awesome human.
Absolutely. And I guess the funny part about all of this is the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? The way that you're talking about building companies, long-term value, entrepreneurial spirit and mindset, what you screen for in employees, it sounds like pretty much very similar things that you would see in traditional business. Right? Like some of the blocking and tackling doesn't change, even though this is new technology and new ways to think about implementing that technology.
Yeah. It's there's that dynamic, but we're always trying to hack the organization, to that point where, we have people in, Berlin and Argentina and LA and DC and Atlanta and all over the place. So you're distributed, and you have to find ways to make that work. And then, some of the even the Block Labs companies, we will launch those out as separate businesses. And so, some of the resources of ops and finance and marketing and PR and some of the technical attributes that we add. I don't want to have, a 1,000-person company, a massive business. So we're actually trying to hack that today. You're right. It looks kind of traditional where you have, an org structure and functional areas, X, Y, and Z. But my goal is to hack that as much as possible in this new distributed, decentralized way, not to force fit it, but it's just like how people want to work. I mean, a developer in Berlin is not going to move to, Chicago. Totally happy there. He's got his family there, and it's going to be more impactful being happy and productive that way. And so, constantly trying to do that, but it's always a challenge.
Absolutely. Very cool. Well, what's one thing about your time in crypto that you wish people knew that they didn't? Right, that something that people don't know that you wish they did know.
I've been a tech entrepreneur and investor for a long, long time, and it's interesting because and you probably see this too, where historically you meet a lot of people that say, "Hey, I want to change the world," and they're building stuff, and I invested and built a lot of pragmatic stuff historically before crypto. And what's interesting is that for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm a part of something that's going to change the world. And that is like the coolest feeling ever. Is like, backing entrepreneurs or seeing entrepreneurs that had that as their mantra was always cool and inspiring. And so finally, I feel like, I could be a part of something, this whole journey that we're all on, and we're still in the earliest days. I could be part of something that changes the world, and that's pretty cool.
Absolutely, it's kind of scary sometimes, right? To think about, or overwhelming at least, that the things you're doing today can actually create incredible change, right? And there's a responsibility that comes with it as well.
Yeah, no, totally, and incredible change. And then it's like incredible. It's a, like such a huge depth of like understanding you need. So like, it's like, you know, people, you know, crypto blockchain experts and all, it's just nonsense. You know, it's like, so many disciplines you need to understand between, you know, finance and tech and anthropology and economics and all these different disciplines. And you might get, you might understand something at those intersections, but it just continues to evolve. And this, the ground shifts underneath our feet every single week in this space, which is, you know, it's part of the fun too.
For sure. All right. So before I finish up, I usually ask a rapid fire set of questions. What do you think the most important company in crypto is other than your own?
I really like the way CZ executes and vibrates at Binance. He's been a dear friend for a long time, with first investor advisor at Binance, and from that original white paper to seeing in the amount of time is pretty profound, and I could be more proud, and I'm in awe actually. So everything he's doing, it's purposeful, and it's done in the right way.
What what's one regulation that you would change or improve if you could?
I think that's the hard part. You know, when you, especially in the U.S., because you have so many different agencies, IRS, SEC, CFTC, all these different dynamics. I think you start, you know, with a compass to say, hey, this space competitively is important, and have a compass to say, you know, this blockchain and an action plan around blockchain is a really keystone piece. And I think if you have the right narrative on that, I think that steamrolls and gets everybody's act together with all these different agencies. So, I mean, I'd love to see more clarity on the utility security, token and get more clarity from that. That's a big friction point and in certain ways irresponsible to not have that. But again, you know, the pace, the time and everything else, I hope we have a better sense of that this year.
For sure. What's the most important book you've ever read?
I would say Sapiens, or another one was The Art of War. It's a book I actually gave to my two teenage kids, which is kind of funny on one hand, but it's it also gives you some good emotional intelligence, some street smarts, some good hacks at life. So Art of War is actually a good one.
Got it. I usually end by letting people ask me one question, but before, we've got to talk about aliens, believer or not?
Absolutely. We're aliens. It's statistically probable that there's other forms of life out there. The question is, like, where are they in comparison to us? And, you know, are we a test planet? Are we a test network for them? Or, you know, I mean, there's so many cool permutations to that, but absolutely. I mean, the universe is huge. And so there's probably other beings out there.
For sure. Are you more scared of space or of the ocean? Like, would you rather go to space or go to the depths of the ocean? This is my new question that I'm fascinated by people's responses.
I don't think we know much about like what's going on in the depths of the ocean. And so I think that's a massive, obviously, area to do. And there's a lot of like tech and improvement we could do for the ocean in general, beyond exploring it and all that stuff. Desalinization, there's all these, there's a few funds out there doing stuff. But space is just, it's so vast and so crazy. And Jeff and I were part of, before Block, this dynamic called Dunvegan Space Systems, which ultimately was turned into a space chain, building satellites, launching satellites for a non-terrestrial a network, and then, you know, how does that evolve the moon and Mars and everything else. But I think this space is just is fascinating to me. But I do like your vibe on asking both questions there.
I've actually been thinking about it more, and I'm much more scared of going to the depths of the ocean than going to space. Like, I'd be excited. I'd be pumped to go to space. Going to the ocean, man, I don't know.
Right? We don't know that much about, like, what's at the bare bottom of the ocean.
Absolutely. All right. What one question you got for me?
I get to ask you a question?
Yeah, that's how we end it. You get one question.
What kind of an imprint or difference do you want to make in either in crypto or in your life going forward? Like, what's the one, not one, or just what's the imprint you want to make?
So I'm going to answer this with two separate components. One is the reason why I'm working on all the things I'm working on is because I think this is the technology that has the broadest and deepest impact on the world, right? It can be the most impactful technology. But actually my goals are much more internal than external. I would like to see us make that change. I think that hopefully I can help be a small piece of it. But my hope is that I'm just happy, right? I think it's more of an internal, just as long as I can be happy, everything else is fine, right? It's kind of probably a silly answer to some people, but I've just over the years come to realize that that kind of personal happiness makes everything else, you can deal with it and you just kind of have no worries, right? That's like the good life to me. So that's really just my goal, and have some fun along the way.
I love the answer. Super genuine. And actually, I think everybody's like, yeah, what he said.
Yeah. Well, look, I hope so. So look, man, I really appreciate this. Obviously big fan of you and what you guys are doing. So, thank you so much for the time. We're going to have to do this again as things kind of continue on. And best of luck to you.
Thanks for having me, Pom.
Another word from our sponsors at Total. They're kind of like Kayak, which helps you find the best flights. But Total helps you find liquidity by aggregating decentralized exchanges and optimally routing trades for execution. Remember, that's total.com/pomp. TOTLE.com/pomp. Go check it out. Let me know what you think. Tweet at me. I'll drop you some fire emojis. Total.com/pomp. Hey everyone, Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.